Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Search for the Starstones by Andre Norton. Narrated by Charles Constant. The Zero Stone. 1. The dark was so thick in this stinking alley that a man might well put his hand out and catch shadows, pull them here or there as if they were curtain stuff. Yet I could not quarrel with the fact that this world had no moon, and that only its stars spotted the night sky, nor that the men of Kunga City did not set torchlights on any but the main ways of that den of disaster. Here the acrid smells were almost as thick and strong as the dark, and under my boots the slime coating the uneven stone pavement was a further risk. While my fear urged me to run, prudence argued that I take only careful step after step, pausing to feel out the way before me. My only guide was an uncertain memory of a city I had known for only 10 days, and those not dedicated to the study of geography. Somewhere ahead, if I was lucky, very, very lucky, there was a door, and on that door was set the head of a godling known to the men of this planet. In the night, the eyes of that head would blaze with welcoming light, because behind the door were torches, carefully tended to burn the night through. And if a man, being hunted through these streets and lanes for any reason, even fresh blood spilled before half the city for witnesses, could lay a hand upon the latch below those blazing eyes, lift it to enter the hall beyond, he had sanctuary from all hunters. My outstretched fingers to the left slid along sweating stone, picking up a foul burden of stickiness as they passed. I had the laser in my right hand. It might buy me moments, a few of them, if I were cornered here, but only a few. And I was panting with the effort that had brought me so far, bewildered by the beginning of this nightmare, which had certainly not been of my making, nor of Vondar's. Vondar. Resolutely I squeezed him from my thoughts. There had been no chance for him. Not from the moment the four green robes had walked so quietly into the taproom, set up their spin wheel, all men there going white or gray of face as they watched those quiet, assured movements, and touched the wheel into life. The deadly arrow which tipped it whirled fatefully to point out, when it came to rest, he who would be an acceptable sacrifice to the demon they so propitiated. We had sat there as if bound, which indeed we had been, in a sense, by the customs of this damnable world. Any man striving to withdraw after the arrow moved would have died, quickly, at the hands of his nearest neighbor. For there was no escape from this lottery. So we had sat there, but not in any fear, as it was not usual that an off-worlder be chosen by the Green Robes. They were not minded to have difficulty thereafter from the patrol, or from powers beyond their own skies, being shrewd enough to know that a god may be great on his own world, and nothing under the weight of an unbeliever's iron fist, when that fist swung down from the stars. Vondar had even leaned forward a little, studying the faces of those about us with that curiosity of his. He was as satisfied as he ever was, having done good business that day, filled himself with as fine a dinner as these barbarians knew how to prepare, and having gained a lead to a new source of Lalor crystals. Also, had he not unmasked the tricks of Hamzar, who had tried to foist on us a Lalor of 6 carats weight, but with a heart flaw? Vondar had triangulated the gem neatly, and then pointed that such damage could not be polished out, and that the crystal, which might have made Hamzar's fortune with a less expert buyer, was an inferior stone in truth, worth only the price of an extra laser charge. A laser charge. My fingers crooked tighter about my weapon. I would willingly exchange now a whole bag of Lalars for another charge waiting at my belt. A man's life is ever worth, at least to him, more than the fabled treasure of Jacquard. So Vondar had watched the natives in the tavern, and they had watched the spinning arrow of death. Then that arrow had wavered to a halt, pointing at no man directly, but to the narrow space which existed between Vondar's shoulder and mine as we sat side by side. And Vondar had smiled then, saying, "It would seem that their demon is somewhat undecided this night, Murdoch." He spoke in basic, but there were probably those there who understood his words. Even then he did not fear or reach for a weapon, though I had never known Vondar to be less than alert. No man can follow the life of a gem buyer from planet to planet without having eyes all around his head, a ready laser, and a nose ever sniffing for the taint of danger. If the demon had been undecided, his followers were not. They came for us. From the long sleeves of their robes suddenly appeared the bind cords used on prisoners they'd dragged to their lord's lair. I took the first of those green robes, beaming across the tabletop, which left the wood scorched and smoking. Vondar moved, but a fraction too late. As the free traders say, his luck spaced, for the man to his left sprang at him, slamming him back against the wall, pinning his hand out of reach of his weapon. They were all yammering at us now, the green robes halting, content to let others take the risk in pulling us down. I caught a second man reaching for Vondar, but the one already struggling with him I dared not ray, lest I get my master too. Then I heard Vondar cry out, the sound speedily smothered in a rush of blood from my lips. We had been forced apart in the struggle, and now, as I slipped along the wall, trying to get beamside on the green robes, my shoulders met no solid surface. I stumbled back and out through a side door into the street. It was then that I ran, heedlessly at first, then dodging into a deep doorway for a moment. I could hear the hunt behind me. From such hunting there was little hope of escape, for they were between me and the spaceport. For a long moment I huddled in that doorway, seeing no possible future beyond a fight to the end. What fleeting scrap of memory was triggered then I did not know, but I thought of the sanctuary past which Hamzar had taken us 3-4 days earlier. His story concerning it flashed into my mind, though at that instant I could not be sure in which direction that very thin hope of safety might lie. I tried to push panic to the back of my mind, picture instead the street before me and how it ran in relation to the city. Training has saved many a man in such straits, and training came to my aid now, for memory had been fostered in me by stiff schooling. I was not the son and pupil of Hywel Djern for naught. Thus and thus I recalled the running of the streets, and thought I had some faint chance of following them. There was this also. Those who hunted me would deem they had all the advantages, and that they need only keep between me and the spaceport, and I would be easy prey, caught deep in the maze of their unfamiliar city. I slipped from the shadow of the door and began a weaving which took me not in the direction they would believe I would be desperately seeking, but veering from it north and west. And so I had come into this alley, slipping and scraping through its noisome muck. My only guides were two, and to see one I had to look back to the tower of the port. Its light was strong and clear across this dark-skied world. Keeping it ever at my right, I took it for a reverse signal. The other I could only catch glimpses of now and again as I scuttled from one shadowed space to the next. It was the watchtower of Kunga, standing tall to give warning against the sudden attacks of the barbarian sea rovers who raided down from the north in the lean seasons of the great cold. The alley ended in a wall. I leapt to catch its crest, my laser held between my teeth. On the top I perched, looking about me, until I decided that the wall would now form my path. It continued to run along behind the buildings, offering none too wide a footing, but keeping me well above ground level. There were dim lights in the back windows of these upper stories, and from one to the next they served me as beacons. When I paused now and then to listen, I could hear the murmur of the hunters. They were spreading out from the main streets into some of the alleys, but they did so cautiously, and I believed they did not face too happily a quarry who might be ready to loose a laser beam from the dark. Time was on their side, for with the coming of dawn, were I still away from the sanctuary, I could be readily picked out of any native gathering by my clothing alone. I wore a modified form of crew dress, suited to the seasoned space traveler, designed for ease on many different worlds, though not keeping to the uniform coloring of a crewman. Vondar had favored a dull olive green for our overtunics. The breast of his worked with the device of a master gemologist. Mine had the same, modified by an apprentice's 2 bars. Our boots were magnet-plated for shipwear, and our undergarment was of 1 piece, like a working crewman's. In this world of long, fringed overrobes and twisted, colored headdresses, I would be very noticeable indeed. There was one small change I could make. I did so now, balancing precariously on my wall perch, once more holding the laser between my teeth as I loosed the seam seal and pulled off my overtunic with its bold blazoning. I rammed it into as small a ball as I could, and teetered dangerously over a scrap of garden to push it into a fork of branches on a thorn bush. Then I crept along the wall top for the distance of four more houses until I came to the end at the rise of another building. From there, I had a choice of leaps, down into the garden or into the maw of another alley. I would have chosen the alley had I not frozen tight against the house wall at the sound from its depths. Something moved there, but certainly no number of men. There was the sucking sound of a foot or feet lifted out of the slime, and I even thought I could hear the hiss of breathing. Whoever crept there was not moving with the openness of those who quested on my trail. My hands had been braced against the house wall, and now my fingers fell into holes there. I explored by touch and knew that I had come upon one of those geometric patterns which decorated the walls of more important buildings, some parts being intaglio and others projecting. As I felt above me, higher and higher, I began to believe that the pattern might extend clear to the roof and offer me a third way out. Once more I crouched, and this time I unsealed my boots, fastening them to the back of my belt. Then I climbed, after pausing for a long moment to listen to sounds below. They were farther away now, near the mouth of the alley. Again my schooling came to my aid, and I pulled myself up those sharply etched hand and toe holds until I swung over an ornamental parapet, past bold incrustations of demon faces set to frighten off the evil powers of natural forces. The roof onto which I dropped sloped inward to a middle opening which gave down three floors to a center court with a core pool into which rainwater would feed during the spring storms. It was purposely smoothed to aid in that transfer of rain to the reservoir, so I crept beside the parapet, my hands anchoring me from one spike of the wall to the next. But I did so with speed, for even in the dark I could see that now I was only a little way from my goal. From this height I could see also the spaceport. There were two ships there, one a passenger cum trader, on which that very morning Vondar had taken passage for us. It was as far from me now as if half the dark dragon curled between. They would know that we had bought passage on it and would keep it cordoned. The other, farther away, was a free trader, and while no one normally interfered with one of those or its crew, I could make no claim on it for protection. Even if I reached sanctuary, what further hope would I have? I pushed aside that fear and turned to examine the immediate prospect of getting to the doorway. Now I would have to descend the outer face of the building into a lighted street. There were more bands of decoration, and I had little doubt they would make me a ladder, if I could go unsighted. However, torches flamed in brackets along that way, and compared with the back streets through which I had fled, this was as light as a concourse on one of the inner planets. Few men were abroad so late with legal reason, and I heard no sounds to suggest that the hunt had spread this far. They must rather be patrolling near the field. I had come this far. There was no retreat now. Giving a last searching glance below, I slipped between two of the ornaments and began the descent. From hold to hold, feeling for those below, trusting to the strength in my fingers and wrists, I worked my way down. I had passed the top story when I came upon a window, my feet thudding home on its jutting sill. I balanced there, my hands on either side, my face to the dark interior. And then I was near startled into letting go my grasp by a shrill scream from within. I was not conscious of making the first few drops of my continued flight down the wall. There was a second scream and a third. How soon would the household be aroused or attention raised in the street? Finally I let go, fell into a roll. Then, not even stopping to put on my boots, I ran as I had not run before, without looking back to see what fury I had roused. Along the house walls, sprinting from one patch of shadow to the next, I dashed. Now I could hear cries behind. At the least, the screamer had aroused members of her own household. But there came a street corner, and memory had served me right. I could sight the bright eyes of the godling on the door. I ran with open mouth, sucking in quick breaths, my boots still fastened to my belt and knocking against my hips, the laser in my hand. On, and always I feared to see someone step into the open between me and the face of the blazing eyes. But there was no halting, and with a last burst of speed I hit against the portal, my fingers scrabbling for the ring below the head. With a jerk I pulled it. For a second or two the door, contrary to promise, seemed to resist my efforts. Then it gave, and I stumbled into a hall where stood the torches which gave light to the beacon eyes. I had forgotten the door as I wavered on, intent only on getting inside, away from the rising clamor in the street. Then I tripped and fell forward on my knees. Somehow I squirmed around, the laser ready. Already the door was swinging shut, shutting off a scene of running men, light gleaming in the bared blades they held. Breathing hard, I watched the door shut by itself, and then was content to sit there for a space. I had not realized how great the strain of my flight had been until this island of safety held me. It was good simply to sit on the floor of that passage and know I need not run. Finally, I roused enough to draw my boots on and look about me. Hemzar's tale of sanctuary had not gone beyond the few facts of the face on the door and the guarantee that no malefactor could be taken from within. I had expected some type of temple to lie behind such a story. But I was not in the court of any fane now, only in a narrow hall with no doors. Very close to me stood a stone rack in which were set two oil-soaked torches, blazing steadily to form the beacon of the door eyes. I got to my feet and rounded that barrier, waiting for a challenge from whoever tended those night lights. With my back to their flames, I saw only more corridor, unbroken, shadows at its far end which could veil anything. With some caution, I advanced. Unlike the glimpses I had had into the various other temples of Kunga, these walls were unpainted, being only the native yellow stone such as cobbled the wider streets. The same stone formed the wide blocks of the floor, and as far as I could see, the ceiling as well. They were worn in places underfoot, as if from centuries of use. Also here and there on the floor were dark splotches, following no pattern, which suggested unpleasantly that some of those who had come this way earlier might have suffered hurts during their flight, and that there had been no effort to clean away such traces. I reached the end of the corridor and discovered it made a sharp turn to the right, one which was not visible until one reached it. To the left was only wall. The new way, being out of the path of the torches, was almost as dark as the alleys. I tried to pierce its dusk, wishing I had a beamer. Finally, I turned the laser on lowest energy, sending a white pencil which scored the stained blocks of the flooring, but gave me light. The new passage was only about 4 paces long. Then I was in a square box of a room, and the laser beam touched upon an unlighted torch in a wall bracket. That blazed, and I switched off the weapon, blinking. I might have been in a room furnished by one of the cheaper inns. Against the far wall was a basin of stone, into which trickled a small runnel of water, the overflow channeled back into the surface of the wall again. There was a bed frame fitted with a netting of cords, a matting of dried and faintly aromatic leaves laid over it. Not a comfortable bed, but enough to keep one's bones from aching too much. There were 2 stools, a small guesting table set between them. They bore none of the customary carving, but were plain, however smoothed by long use. In the wall opposite the bed was a niche in which sat a flagon of dull metal, a small basket, and a bell. But there were no doors to the room, and I could see no other exit save the corridor along which I had come. It began to impress me that this vaunted sanctuary was close to a prison, if the trapped dare not venture forth again. I forced the torch out of its wall hold and carried it about, searching the walls, the ceiling, the floor, to find no break. At last I wedged it back into place. The bell by the flagon next held my attention, and I picked it up. A bell suggested signaling. Perhaps it would bring me an explainer, or an explanation. I rang it with as much force as I could get into a snap of the wrist. For so large a bell, it gave forth a very muted tinkle, though I tried it several times, waiting between each for an answer. That did not come until at last I slammed it back into the niche and went to sit on the bed. When the delayed answer to my impatient summons came, it was startling enough to bring me to my feet, laser-drawn.
For a voice spoke out of the air, seemingly only a few feet away.
"To Nausicaä you have come. In his shadow abide, for the waning of 4 torches.
It was a moment before I realized that that voice had not used the lisping speech of Kunga, but Basic. Then they must know me for an off-worlder. "Who are you?" My own words echoed hollowly as that voice had not. "Let me see you." Silence only. I spoke again, first promising awards if my plight was told at the port or if they would give me help in reaching it. Then I threatened, speaking of the ill which came when off-worlders were harmed, though I guessed that perhaps they were shrewd enough to know how hollow those threats were. There was no answer, no sign I was even heard. It could have been a recording which addressed me. And who the guardians here were, I did not know either. A priesthood? Then they might be akin to the green robes, and so would do me no favors save those forced upon them by custom. At last I curled into the bed and slept, and dreamed, very vivid dreams which were not fancies spun by the unconscious mind, but memories out of the past. So, as it is said, a dying man sometimes does, I relived much of my life, which had not been so long in years. My beginnings were overshadowed by another, Hywel Djern, who in his time had had a name to be reckoned with on more than one planet, and who could speak with authority in places where even the patrol must walk with cat-soft feet, fearing to start what would take death and blood to finish. My father had a past as murky as the shallow inlets of Hawaii after autumn storms. I do not think that any man save himself knew the whole of it. Certainly we did not. For years after his death I still came across hints, bits and pieces, which each time opened another door to show me yet another Hywel Djern. Even when I was young, at times when a coup of more than ordinary cleverness warmed whatever organ served him as a heart, he launched into a tale which was perhaps born out of his own adventuring, though he spoke always of some other man as the actor in it. Always this story was a lesson aimed at impressing upon his listeners some point of bargaining or of action in crisis. And all his tales made more of things than of people, who were only incidental, being the owners or obtainers of objects of beauty or rarity. Until he was close to 50 planet years old, he was prime assessor to the Vipa Stampfa, a sector boss of the Thieves Guild. My father never tried to hide this association. In fact, it was a matter of pride to him, since he seemed to have an inborn talent, which he fostered by constant study for the valuing of unusual loot. He was a valuable man, ranking well above the general core of that illegal combine. However, he appeared to have lacked ambition to climb higher, or else he simply had an astute desire to remain alive and not a target of the ambition of others. Then Estampfa met a rootless borer plant, which someone with ambition secreted in his private collection of exotic blooms, and came to an abrupt finish. My father withdrew prudently and at once from the resulting scramble for power. Instead, he bought out of the guild and migrated to Angkor. For a while, I believe, he lived very quietly. But during that period, he was studying both the planet and the openings for lucrative business. It was a sparsely settled world on the pioneer level, not one which at that time attracted the attention of those with wealth, nor of the guild. But perhaps my father had already heard rumors of what was to come. Within a space of time, he paid court to a native woman whose father operated a small hocklock for pawning, as well as a trading post near the only spaceport. Shortly after his marriage, the father-in-law died of an off-world fever, a plague ship having made a crash landing before it could be warned off. The fever also decimated most of the port authorities. But Hywel Djern and his wife proved immune and carried on some of the official duties at this time, which entrenched them firmly when the plague had run its course and the government was restored. Then some 5 years later, the Voltorian star cluster was brought into cross-stellar trade by the Fortuna Combine, and Angkor suddenly came to life as a shipping port of exchange. My father's business prospered, though he did not expand the original Hawklock. With his many off-world contacts, both legal and illegal, he did well, but to outward appearances only in a modest way. All spacers sooner or later lay hands on portable treasures or curiosities. To have a buyer who asked no questions and paid promptly was all they wanted at any port where the gaming tables and other planet-side amusements separated them too fast from flight pay. This quiet prosperity lasted for years, and appeared to be all my father wanted. 2. If Hywel Jern had contracted his marriage for reasons of convenience, it was a stable one. There were children, myself, Fascal, and Darina. My father took little interest in his daughter, but he early bent more than a little energy to the training of Fascal and me, not that Fascal showed any great promise along the lines Hywel Jern thought important. It was the custom for us to assemble at a large table in an inner room we lived over and behind the shop for the evening meal. And at that time my father would bring out and pass around some item from his stock, first asking an opinion of it, its value, age, nature. Gems were a passion with him, and we were forced to learn them as other children might scan book tapes for general knowledge. To my father's satisfaction, I proved an apt pupil. In time, he centered most of his instruction on me, since Fascal, either because he could not or because he stubbornly would not learn, again and again made some mistakes which sent our father into one of his cold and silent withdrawals. I never saw Hywel Jern lose his temper, but his cold displeasure was not to be courted. It was not so much that I feared such censure as that I was really fascinated and interested in what he had to teach. Before I was out of childhood, I was allowed to judge the pledges in the shop, and whenever one of the gem merchants who visited my father from time to time came, I was displayed as the star pupil. So through the years, our house became one divided, my mother, Fascal, and Darina on one side, my father and I on the other. And our contact, or mine, with other children of the port was limited, my father drawing me more and more into the shop to learn his old trade of valuing. Some strange and beautiful things passed through our hands in those days. Part were sold openly, others remained in his lockboxes, to be offered in private transactions, and of those I did not see all. There were things from alien ruins and tombs, made before the time that our species burst into space. There were pieces looted from empires which had vanished into the dust of history so long past that even their planets had been buried. And there were others new from the workshops of the inner systems, where all the creative art of a jeweler is unleashed to catch the eye of a veep with a bottomless purse. My father liked the old pieces the most. Sometimes he would hold a necklet or a bracelet, which by its form had never been meant to encircle a human wrist, and speculate about who had worn it and the civilization from which it had come. And he demanded of those who brought him such trinkets as clear a history of their discovery as he could obtain, putting on tapes all he could learn. I think that these tapes in themselves might have proven a rich treasure house for seekers of strange knowledge, and I have wondered since if Fascal ever suspected their worth and used them so. Perhaps he did, for in some ways he proved to be more shrewd than my father. In one of our round-table meetings after an evening meal, my father produced such an alien curiosity. He did not pass it from hand to hand, as was his wont, but laid it on the well-polished board of a dead black creel wood, and sat staring at it as if he were one of the fakirs from the drylands seeking to read a housewife's future in a polished seed pod. It was a ring, or at least it followed that form. But the band must have been made for a finger close to the size of two of ours laid together. The metal was dull, pitted, as if from great age. Its claw setting held a stone bigger than my thumbnail, in proper proportion to the band. And it was as dull and unappealing as the metal, colorless, no sparkle or hint of life in it. Also, the longer one studied it, the more the idea grew in mind that this was the corpse of something which might have once had life and beauty, but was long since dead. I had, at that first viewing, a disinclination to touch it, though I was always avid to examine these bits and pieces my father used for our instruction. "Out of another tomb? I wish you would not bring these corpse ornaments to the table," My mother spoke more sharply than was usual. At that time, it struck me.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?